Welcome to the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kristen Speck. The Alaska World Affairs Council brings the world to Alaska. World leaders, journalists, authors, educators, and entrepreneurs join Alaskans in a conversation about world affairs. This week, the Rasmussen Chair of Economics at the University of Alaska Anchorage, Dr. Jim Murphy, speaks on natural resource management in the developing world. Dr. Murphy comes to the University of Alaska Anchorage and Alaska from the University of Massachusetts Amherst, where he has taught and researched since 1999. Professor Murphy's research focuses on the use of experimental methods to address environmental policy and natural resource management issues. His most recent research includes a multi-year project conducting field experiments in Colombia to understand how rural communities manage small-scale natural resources, a study on subsistence harvest in Alaska and Far East Russia, a project investigating issues related to enforcement of and compliance with environmental regulations, and research on the design of water markets in California. Outlining his research, Dr. Murphy has jointly authored 13 articles or book chapters since his arrival at UAA. While his initial appointment to the Rasmussen Chair was for a year and a half, UAA recently extended Dr. Murphy's appointment for an additional 3 years and offered him a permanent faculty position. Since accepting the position at UAA, Dr. Murphy has relocated to Anchorage with his wife and son and no longer plans to return to the University of Massachusetts. On Friday, October 31st, Dr. Jim Murphy spoke on natural resource management in the developing world at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska. In partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, KSKA presents the Rasmussen Chair of Economics at the University of Alaska Anchorage, Dr. Jim Murphy.
Thanks to all of you for coming, and I guess happy Halloween. I'm going to take, as speaker, I guess I get the liberty of getting to change the title a little bit. When I was first asked to talk to you guys, one of the things that immediately came to mind is some of the work that I'm doing with some colleagues down in Colombia about natural resource management, and I thought what I'd talk about today was sort of the implications of what we've learned down there and how that can be generalized from just Colombia to other developing countries. And then as I started putting the talk together, and here's the danger in first putting the title together and then thinking about the talk later, I realized I wanted to talk a little more broadly about natural resource management, not just in developing countries, but really throughout the world, including the industrialized worlds. And so what I want to do is sort of reframe this and talk generally about natural resources, the property rights that surround those resources, and then the institutions that govern those resources. And in some ways you can think of this, just to be a little catchy, as the three R's. I'm talking about the resources, and then I'm going to talk about the rights, basically who has the right to use these resources. And then on top of that, there's still the rules or the institutions, which are basically, even though you've got a right to use a resource, what are the rules that determine appropriate use of that resource, even though you have a right? I didn't realize that this was also going to be broadcast to rural Alaska. If I had known that ahead of time, I would have prepared a little bit extra just to touch to that audience, because a lot of what I'm going to say, you'll see, even though I won't necessarily address rural Alaska themes directly, you'll see a lot of parallels, and there's a lot of close connections to what I'm talking about today that would also fit in with rural Alaska. So really, at the end of the day, what's this talk about? Well, what I want to talk to you about is what I'm calling managing the commons, basically shared natural resources. And many of you may have heard about a common expression, the tragedy of the commons. When you have shared natural resources, the inevitable fate is often described as a path towards ruin, and common property management won't work. I'm going to try to some extent, try to dispel that myth, but also share some thoughts on when it works and when common property regimes do and don't work. Generally, what I'm talking about are small-scale, small resources, local resources that are community-based systems of self-governance, where there's some local autonomy in managing the resource. And when I talk about small-scale, this is where you can think about rural Alaska. You can think about, and this is very common in developing countries. And so when I first thought I'll talk about developing countries, most natural resource management, most subsistence harvests are often small-scale resources, local resources, And there's often some sort of local sets of rules and norms that govern determine appropriate uses. And then also what I want to talk a little bit about, sort of, you know, my area of expertise is in experimental economics. And so what I want to share you a little bit with you about today is not just what's going on in some of these rural communities, but also what we've learned from doing some work with some of our students, in fact, in the lab, and how that relates back to these questions about natural resource management. So throughout the talk, some themes that I'd like you to look for, basically some take-home messages. First, I want to emphasize the need for institutional diversity. It's really important when thinking about when we're thinking about how should these natural resources be managed, how should subsistence resources be managed, it's really essential to recognize the local knowledge that's there, the local rules and norms, which may not be officially written down rules and regulations, but certainly some sort of norms that determine appropriate behavior, and then certain local customs about how these resources are managed. And I'll explain why those are important. And one really important take-home message here is that there is no one-size-fits-all panacea. And that applies to all different ways of managing. To each resource, the emphasis here is on focusing on the situation on the ground for the particular question it is that you're asking, and not trying to come in with some sort of a particular agenda. And I'll give you some examples. And I've given a lot of these talks where people do come at these problems with agendas and often can come to misguided conclusions. And so I'll talk a little bit about that. Before I can really segue into my talk, I can't talk about natural resource use in developing countries or subsistence harvests without acknowledging Eleanor Ostrom. She's everything that I'm going to say today, some of it's my own ideas and my own work, some of it stems from her, but she is basically the person from which all of these ideas about managing commons emanate. And it's really impossible to talk about it without at least acknowledging her. If there were a Nobel Prize in political science, she'd probably be first in line to get it. And then also, as a good co-author, I also want to acknowledge the other people that I'm working with, which are John Strandlin at the University of Massachusetts, and then some colleagues down in Colombia, Juan Camilo Cardenas, Maria Alejandra Velez, and Maria Claudia Lopez. So a lot of what I'm going to share to you is my own work, but I couldn't have done it without some of these other people as well. So first, what do I mean by the commons? When I talk about a common pool resource, and again, for those of you in rural ESCE, you can think about when I talk about subsistence resources, very loosely speaking, what I'm talking about are shared natural resources. And these natural resources have a common characteristic. First off, they're limited. It's a finite resource. There's only so much fish in the sea. And not only that, but if I harvest a fish, it's not available for you to harvest. So there's a limited resource, and there's not. When I eat something, it's not there for you. What turns this into a commons problem is this third component. Either it's difficult to exclude users, and here you can think about open access fisheries, or there's some form of common ownership. Maybe it's possible to exclude users, but for whatever reason, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, the communities choose to have some form of common ownership or some common structure to determine how that resource is used. The key thing here is that there's no private property rights. And some classic examples, open access fisheries often suffer from this, and there's lots of examples of fisheries that have been over-harvested, and you know, the cod fisheries in the Northeast. You also talk about irrigation systems in developing nations. A lot of those are community-based efforts to put together an irrigation system. In a lot of areas, for example, I'll talk about in the Swiss Alps, communal grazing lands to run cattle out on the fields, forests. A more modern example, internet bandwidth, the way that that's managed today. In a lot of cases, if I start downloading lots of stuff, that slows down your ability to download things. So the speed with which you have access to the internet is contingent upon how many other users are out there and how much they're using it as well. And then finally, sort of on a global scale, the Earth's atmosphere is probably the ultimate in common pool resources, particularly today with a lot of talk about greenhouse gases and global warming. There's a finite ability for the Earth to absorb these greenhouse gases, but there really is no property right structure in place right now to define who gets to use that resource, who gets to emit greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. There's lots of conversations about how that should be managed, but there is still a common pool resource type problem where there is the potential for a tragedy of the commons to occur. This potential problem of common ownership goes back at least to the Greeks and probably before that. People were aware of some of the challenges. Aristotle, he said, for that which is common to the greatest number has the least care bestowed upon it. Everyone thinks chiefly of his own and hardly at all of the common interest. And so here, what he's describing is what I would call a social dilemma, that for a lot of these shared resources, there's a tension that people face between pursuing individual interest and pursuing what's good for the group. And so when you face this tension, often what happens, or what can happen, not necessarily what will happen, but what can happen is individual interests might trump group interests, and that's when you see overexploitation of resources. Scott Gordon also talked about this same problem. In 1954, he asked the question of, hey, wait a minute, if the ocean resources are so rich, why are fishermen poor? And this fish are not a renewable resource. Why isn't this a problem with other natural resources? What makes fisheries different from other resources that fishermen are so poor? And he came to the conclusion that overexploitation in the fishery is really a manifestation of the fact that these resources are owned in common and exploited under conditions of individual competition. And then where the tragedy of the commons phrase gets coined is from Garrett Hardin in 1968. And he talked about, ruin is the destruction towards which all men rush, each pursuing his own best interest in a society that believes in the freedom of the commons. Freedom in a commons brings ruin to all. Okay, so that's a pretty strong statement. And his recommendation for overcoming this type of problem was either Leviathan, a big government stepping in and sort of trying to solve the problem, or imposing private property rights. Now, anecdotes don't prove anything, but they certainly make a talk a little more interesting than me sort of regaling the history of people complaining about problems in the commons. And I might be a little bit ahead of the day since it's Halloween and not Thanksgiving, but following the lead of our department stores, it's not too early to start talking about the next holiday when we're not done the first one. So I'm going to talk about Thanksgiving. And I guess at the risk of over-dramatizing it, I guess I'll tell you the true story of Thanksgiving. Some of you may have heard this, some of you may not. Well, when the Pilgrims settled in 1620, farmlands were actually owned in commons. There were no private property rights to the initial farmlands. Now, long story short, that wasn't necessarily by choice. That was a system that was imposed on them by the investors who basically financed the trip over to the colonies in the first place. And the fact that it wasn't by choice was actually a major source of the problem that the original colonists had. By 1623, they had 3 years of famine. They were having a hard time feeding themselves, and William Bradford wasn't sure what to do. Theft increased, which in a puritanical society seems kind of contradictory. And as did a surge in what we'll call illnesses, which was basically a lack of desire to work, which is contrary to what you would think of as the Protestant work ethic. So Bradford said, at length, this is out of his diaries, at length, after much debate, I, with the chiefest among them, gave way that they should set corn every man for his own particular, and in that regard to trust themselves, and so assign to every family a parcel of land. So basically what he said was, we're having a hard time feeding ourselves, and the source of this problem is common property. So I'm going to impose a private property regime. And by the way, for those of you guys who are wondering where is he going with this, you'll see in a minute. Well, he said that this had very good success, for it made all hands very industrious, and so as much more corn was planted than otherwise would have been. So basically that conversion from a common property regime to a private property regime solved their particular problem. Okay, and as a result, we had the first Thanksgiving in 1623, which was celebrating the first good harvest after many years of famine. And one version of that story is that the primary source of that famine wasn't necessarily the bad weather, but just basically self-imposed because of the property right regime that they had, common property. Now, a lot of people, particularly on the libertarian side of things, will pick up on this story and say, see, look, here's proof that common property fails. And private property trumps common property. I'm going to skip over this. And just to give you a couple of examples of some quotes that, you know, I see these types of quotes all the time, and when I have conversations with people, I'll hear this often. Private property is the only institutional arrangement that will permit a society to be productive, free, a peaceful, free, and just. The only way to avoid tragedy of the commons and natural resources and wildlife is by creating a system of private property rights. And then this one's my favorite. This was by the Fraser Institute, and they were talking about how the first peoples in Canada were incapable of managing their own natural resources. And really, they're rushing down to the bottom there. Collective property, which is how the resource was managed, is a path to poverty. And private property is the path to prosperity. So again, this is what I see here is an adherence to a principle which may solve many problems, but doesn't necessarily solve all problems. There's a lot of different... So I've talked about a resource. We're going to talk about a shared natural resource. And if you want, you can think of this as subsistence fisheries if you want to. You can think of this as a communal grazing land, whatever. There's a number of different ways that you can assign property rights. One of those will definitely lead to a tragedy of the commons, and that's open access. No rules, no norms about appropriate behavior, and no property rights. Basically, nobody owns this thing, so let's all have at it. That will almost inevitably lead to a tragedy of the commons. Common property, where the resources are held by a group of people who can exclude others, may or may not lead to a tragedy of the commons. And this is a subtle point that Garrett Hardin missed. And people who are talking about private property trumps common property, that's one of the points that they're missing. And I'll give you some examples in a minute. But what I'd like you to take away from this talk is, down the bottom here, this key point. Advocating a single set of rules or some broad abstractions can actually make the problem worse. Okay, and some examples would be things like, I was at a meeting with fisheries economists down there. Everyone, you're economists, we love transferable fishing quota, ITQs. And if you talk to a fishery economist down there, you'll hear quota markets are the only way to solve fishery problems, and any fishery that doesn't have quotas is making a mistake, and we just need to get that changed. And I believe it or not, I hear that often. There are many cases where I do believe that quota markets work. I also believe there's cases where they might not work. And I don't want to go into something with a blind adherence to, let's get these guys to implement quota, coming in with a solution without necessarily knowing what the problem is to begin with. And likewise, talking about privatization, for example. I'm a fan of privatization. I think it's a great idea in some cases, but not in all cases. Private property rights are great. And my students will tell you that when I talk to them, I do have a strong belief in private property rights, free markets, individual responsibility, individual accountability. I think it makes a lot of sense under some conditions and in some cases. But I won't go into these things thinking blindly that this always is going to solve everybody's problems. There's challenges with private property rights, and some of these kind of get glossed over. I wouldn't say they're unsolvable problems, but they are challenges that need to be addressed. First off, it can be difficult to define a property right. And let me give you a tangible example of why it might be difficult to define a property right. There's a fishery in Sri Lanka, and this is basically a subsistence fishery, and there's only two places in the community where they could access the fish. There's only two good fishing spots. But they call them beach seines, basically set nets. And these nets are a half mile long, takes a lot of time and effort to get these nets out there. Again, there's only two places where you can set them. There's 20 groups of people that want to put nets out into the water. All right, if we wanted to define property rights, what do we put the property right to? Is it access to the beach? Well, access to the beach might help, you know, sort of take turns. But then when? Because certain times of day are better than other times of day. And then certain times of day are better, but only depending upon the weather. So what are we defining here? Are we defining access to the beach? Are we access to the beach at particular points in time? Or are we talking about access to the fish? You know, so defining what that property right would be is actually very difficult. The community was actually able to come up with a very sophisticated set of rules for rotating basically who took turns. And it was amazing to see what they came up with. And it was kind of a neat little system. It was a rotation system. Everyone takes turns. And at the end of the day, on average, the harvest for everybody pretty much evened out. Anyone who pays attention to fisheries in Alaska, we can talk about quota all we want. We might agree in principle that quota might make sense, but the devil's in the details. How are we going to allocate those property rights? Allocation of property rights can be challenging. And then in developing countries, the other big issue is limited enforcement. Property rights are useless if they're not enforced. And when we were down in Colombia, they're telling us, look, some of these communities would say, I don't even know. Yeah, there's some rules and laws and regulations. I don't know what they are. I can't tell you. The regulators never come. Other communities will say, well, we know when the regulators are coming because the pilots will radio us ahead of time and let us know. And so the respect for that authority may not be there. And if there's not a strong regulatory presence, enforcement is meaningless. And so private property rights might not work in that particular setting. On the flip side, there are many examples, and I'll give you a couple, of successfully managed, collectively owned, self-governing institutions. But I also, like I said, there's no one-size-fits-all. I'm going to give you some examples of successes. I can also give you many examples of failures as well. But why do these exist in the first place is an interesting question. Why are some successful and others not? And then what lessons can be learned? And that's sort of one of the themes that I want to bring out today. So I want to take you to the Swiss Alps. In Tschopel, Switzerland, agriculture, farmland, you know, raising food for your family, hay for your cattle, that's all on private land holdings. And people, because there's private land holdings, are clearly familiar with the pluses and minuses, the ups and downs of private property. But grazing on the alpine meadows, running your cattle out on the fields, that's on common lands. Now, you can't say, well, that's because they didn't understand private property rights, because they have private property rights. That common property right institution has been in effect since 1483. So for over 500 years, they have a common property arrangement. They've consciously decided not to have a private property arrangement, and they don't have over-harvesting, which sort of is the flip side of my pilgrim story, I guess, which raises two questions. Why are they successful and the pilgrims weren't? The simple answer with the pilgrims was that common property arrangement for them wasn't by their design. It was by somebody else's, and it was the only way for them to get funding, so they kind of had to buy into it. So why are they successful? And then also, why are they doing the common property in the first place? Because it's important to understand why might common property make sense in some instances. Again, not in all instances, but there's a couple. And if you don't understand why these people have these collective arrangements, trying to fix the problem, again, might make it worse. Well, in the Swiss Alps, there's a couple of things that they did that helped them to be successful. First off, they were able to limit access just to citizens in the community. And if I moved into that village right now and bought up some land, that doesn't guarantee me access to the grazing lands. I have to get voted in. They had a wintering rule, make it costly to maintain a large herd of cattle. So the problem here that they face is if the grazing lands are held in common, and so I don't incur the costs of the grazing, I'm going to get lots of cattle, have them graze for free, and then go sell them in the market. And everyone else is going to do that, and all of a sudden, the pasture lands aren't so great. Well, they had a wintering rule, which said, look, I can't run any more cows out on those fields than I can carry over the winter. And they were able to enforce that with fines. And in fact, the person who was responsible for enforcing those fines got to keep half the fines, so that gave him a very strong incentive to make sure that this rule was enforced. Okay? So now, if I got to keep cows over the winter, I'm going to think really hard about how many cows I'm going to graze out on the fields. And then finally, and this was really important, those rules were voted on by the citizens. So in some ways, this is not too different than, say, a homeowners association down in South Anchorage or something like that. But what that gets you is buy-in to the rules and regulations. This isn't something you didn't agree to. Now, why might common property make sense? And this is some work that we're doing right now out in some of the villages out in the Kuskokwim tries to answer these questions. And probably one of the biggest reasons why common property arrangements or collective management might make sense is risk pooling. And what do I mean by this? I'll give you an example. Think about I'm a teacher. I like to think about very simple worlds that don't really exist, but we'll talk about a simple world where there's really just two pieces of land. They're adjacent. One of them's yours and one of them's mine, right? And we're both going to, you know, farm those lands and feed our families. Both of those pieces of land are very productive. Okay, I can raise enough food there to feed not just myself, but your family as well if I have to. And if you don't want the food, that's fine. I'll go sell it in the market. There's only one problem. When it rains, we get lots of rain. You have productive fields. I have productive fields. We're all happy. But every once in a while, we live in two separate microclimates. One of us is going to experience a drought. You don't get rain, you don't get food, you starve. Okay? Well, if you live in the United States, you buy something called insurance, crop insurance, and you're covered. If you live in a remote region of a developing country, I'm not sure what you do. Well, one thing you can do is say, look, we know that one of us is going to experience droughts every once in a while. So let's hedge risk and basically create an insurance portfolio by working these lands in common, because that's the only way that we know that every once in a while one of these lands is going to go bad. We don't know which one, and so we're going to share the risk. And so we think of it as a sophisticated insurance mechanism. If you don't understand that, and you go in and say, you guys are having problems, you need private property rights. I'm hosed if you enforce private property rights on me and I get a drought and I can't go to insurance and go to insurance markets. So it's really important to understand why these might make sense, again, in some cases. Other reasons might be economies of scale, building infrastructure. And the classic example here would be irrigation systems. Again, in developing countries, a lot of times what will happen is the villagers will get together and they'll basically dig giant ditches. Well, that takes a lot of work. I can't do it by myself. I need help. So will you give me a hand? Well, sure, but what's in it for me? Well, when the water comes through, we'll share it. Okay. And then also, in the case of the Swiss Alps, grazing land can be relatively low productivity, and we need large tracts of land. And it might make sense, actually, for rather than having my cow run on a small piece of land and your cow to run on a small piece of land, for both of our cows to run together on a large piece of land. So there's a lot of what I call long-enduring, very successful, common pool resource cases. I talked about the Swiss Alps. The village in Sri Lanka did incredibly well for a very long time until one problem kicked in. The government built a road. And what happened is the rotation system, they had figured out that very successfully let them basically equalize harvest so that everyone had enough to eat. Everyone understood the rules. Everyone had a buy-in to the rules. These weren't written down anywhere, but everyone just sort of agreed. The people who study these villages said there was no conflicts over who had access to the beaches at which point in time. Everybody knew. But when you build a road and somebody else comes in and doesn't know about those rules, and they just sort of show up with their nets and start harvesting and then take those back to the village and selling them, it undermined that rotation system. So properties. First off, generally, these self-managed systems work well when they're local, small scale, regional. People know each other. So we're thinking villages and watersheds. Users often have a stake in the resource, a significant stake. So often we're talking about subsistence resources here. There's also a common understanding for how the resource works to begin with. I can't come up with a sophisticated rotation system for harvesting fish in Sri Lanka if I don't understand how the fish respond to weather patterns and times of day and which beaches are good and which beaches aren't. I need to know how the resource works to begin with. I need to know when I do something, how does that affect the resource? I also need to know how that affects you, because we're working together on this. And this is also very important. Social norms defining proper behavior. And these might not be formal rules. And I'll give you an example. I'll pick on Ted for a second just to make sure he's paying attention. I was forewarned that Ted likes to embarrass speakers. You know, that's okay. But there's limits to it. Now, if he pulls off some sort of good-natured joke or whatever, you know, that's fine. I can roll with it. But there's a limit to how far he can go. At some point, it's no longer appropriate. Now, if you take me into a room and say, quantify what Ted can do that's appropriate and not appropriate, I can't do that. But if he gets up and does something or says something, he'll know right away whether or not what he did was appropriate, not only by my response, but by your response. And I have a feeling he's going to care. If he gets a bunch of cold eyes staring at him because he harassed the speaker just a little too much, that's going to affect what he does next time. And those social norms that determine appropriate behavior are very important also in resource management, particularly in small-scale communities where you can't have big state government coming in and enforcing everything. Often these people are left to their own devices to solve problems. Trust is important. If I'm going to cooperate with you, I kind of need to know that I trust you. How do I know you're not going to stick it to me later? Some local autonomy is important. Doesn't necessarily mean exclusive autonomy. There's lots of examples of co-management arrangements where the local communities have some say in the resource use, but then the state also comes in and has some say as well. So there's sort of layers of management that are applied. But there's at least some buy-in. Otherwise, it becomes a game against the government. That's when the radioing is saying, hey, the inspectors are coming, pull your nets out of the water. That's when that happens, when there's no buy-in. It's a game against the regulators. But you wouldn't do that to your neighbor. The rules, of course, have to be aligned with the resource characteristics, and they have to be able to adapt quickly to change. And the failure in Sri Lanka was exactly because it wasn't able to adapt quickly enough to change. The road comes in, and not only did the new users coming in not know what those norms and customs were, but there wasn't enough time to adapt, and that fishery collapsed. And this last one is probably the most important. Some form of an enforcement mechanism. You need to be able to monitor behavior. You need to be able to sanction inappropriate use. And, stealing a page from Ronald Reagan, there's a trust but verify. Even my friends, even my neighbors, I still want to keep an eye on what they're doing to make sure that there's appropriate use. Now, there's a lot of evidence to show, first off, people will punish others for inappropriate use, even at a cost to themselves. So in the case of the Swiss Alps, punishing others actually was kind of profitable. But there's actually a lot of cases where people will take money out of their own pockets or use some of their own time to admonish people for doing something that's wrong, even at risk to themselves. The other thing that's really interesting, and this kind of goes back to my TED analogy, people are often more responsive to social sanctions than they are to financial sanctions. So you think about that for a second. When you're trying to think about how to manage something, it might be easy to talk about imposing fines for inappropriate behavior. If you get caught, you pay a fine. But when I was in San Francisco, they started putting in fines for going over the carpool lanes over the Bay Bridge. And the fines weren't very big. There weren't a lot of police on the streets early on. And there was a lot of Mercedes-Benzes going over the bridge with single-occupant vehicles who figured out that for every 10 trips, the $20 fine that I was going to pay was perfectly fine. It was just the price of going over the bridge. So, of course, sometimes people are not responsive to financial sanctions, at least not if they're not large enough. So problems with blueprints, one size doesn't fit all. So again, when thinking about private property rights, for example, I think they're fantastic in lots and lots of cases. But there's lots of examples, particularly in subsistence communities, where private property rights might not make sense. And not just private property rights, but government management might also not make sense. There's lots of examples of government institutions that don't work. It's easy to pick on the government. But in developing countries, there's lots of instances where the national government will form an ecosystem reserve, basically create a national park to preserve the ecosystem. You go down there and you talk to people that live nearby, they don't know what you're talking about. So much for government intervention if the people who live right next to the resource don't know that there's a national park that they're living in. So it's important to recognize the local situation and pay attention to local norms, customs. And I'll give you a picture of what can happen, and then I'll start to wrap up pretty soon. Here's an example of a Nepali irrigation system. The government, in a very well-meaning endeavor, tried to replace on the left, these are earth-lined canals, they're just ditches, with a more modern irrigation system. Very well-intended project. They improved the physical infrastructure. They paid absolutely no attention to the human or social infrastructure. And as a result, what happened, even though they had these beautiful canals, all of the focus was on the engineering, and the new system was actually less productive than the old system because they completely ignored in building those canals, there was a whole code about who helps to maintain the infrastructure, who gets to take water out of the system based on how much effort was put in, and all of a sudden these pretty new canals showed up and they weren't exactly sure what to do with them. Doesn't mean you shouldn't put new canals in places where they need them, but it's that you should at least recognize sort of the rules on the ground before you go in with the concrete line canals. And then lastly, to wrap up a little bit, a lot of what I do is with experiments. And so to try and study this, one way to study a lot of these problems is to go out to villages, talk to people, see what's going on. But what you can't do is construct the what if the government were to come in, how would you respond types of things, because you don't know. So a lot of what we'll do is going to have people do role-playing games where they make money to do it. One of the common themes that comes out of that is that, first off, the tragedy of the commons doesn't occur when, except for cases where you have open access. That tragedy of the commons problem is based on what we like to teach our students about rational, self-interested behavior. I only care about me, and I don't really care about you too much. And everything that I do in an economic setting is driven by self-interest. That model does an incredibly good job predicting behavior in open markets. If you want to look at the New York Stock Exchange, rational self-interest is a great predictor. However, in field studies, people have a large mix of motives. Rational self-interest does exist, but there are also people out there who are what I call conditional cooperators. I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine, right? There's also actually some people who are unconditional cooperators. I'll scratch my wife's back as often as she wishes. I mean, no, at some point she'll probably scratch mine, but I'm not doing it because she's going to scratch my back. I'm doing it because I want to. It's unconditional cooperation. And some people are just conformists. I see everybody else scratching people's backs. I probably should be doing that too. And there's a lot of evidence in some one of the studies that we did, the driving force behind behavior is just not wanting to be different. And so if you want to see successful management in some of these communities, the key is to get the norm in the right place. And as long as you establish a norm of cooperative behavior, I don't want to be the only one who's free riding on this. I'll stick out like a sore thumb. So some other lessons. When given the opportunity, people will develop rule systems and punish noncompliance, but not always. Again, this is not a panacea. People are more responsive to social sanctions than financial penalties. I already mentioned that. This is a strong one. Weakly enforced rules imposed by external regulators can actually make things worse. Okay, and this is the if you don't get buy-in, where you and I are working together on this, and we're not doing great, but we're not doing too bad, and then all of a sudden somebody else comes in and says, I got the solution for you, and top down and pushes it on you. Well, now it's their problem. You know, we're in this together, and we may not be doing great, but we've got to solve this, and we need to work together. Now we can just shift, it's their problem. And now it's okay for me to take too many fish out of the sea because, well, I got away with it. That doesn't sound a lot different than, say, speeding down the highway. You know, when I, you know, in New England, I haven't seen it so much up here, but in New England, where I came from, you drive on the rural highways, and if I pass a speed trap along the way, and it's a dark night, as other cars are coming my way, I start flashing my lights to let them know there's a speed trap. Now, if I'm a good citizen, I should be keeping my mouth shut because he's speeding, and he shouldn't be speeding, and somebody could really get hurt. But no, I flash my lights. I'm like, hey, slow down. There's a cop up ahead. You don't want to get caught. It's a game against the government. And there's all sorts. I mean, now I, you know, I see there's websites out there where you can post information about where the speed traps are. Well, I mean, that's not. Anyway, I don't want to go too far with that. But the point being that, you know, by shifting that responsibility away from the individuals and onto the state, can actually change behavior possibly in counterproductive ways, particularly when they're weakly enforced. And in developing countries, that's often the case because there's not enough money for regulators to be out there watching what's going on. And then lastly, one study that we did that I don't really have time to dwell on, there's a lot of regional variability in this. Okay, we played some games where in one community we let people sort of develop bottom-up rules, and they did fantastic working together. And that mapped in exactly with what was going on in the community where they had fishermen's associations and they had local responsibility for managing the resource. When we gave them top-down rules and said, you guys can't do this and this and this, they sort of pushed back and actually we made things worse in this little stylized game by imposing rules on them because they lived in a world where they worked together. And in fact, the state, they didn't even know, they sort of knew who was responsible for managing the resource at a state level, but they were never there. They were kind of left to their own devices. And then in another village, the opposite happened. They knew that they needed state intervention, and there's lots of reasons for why that, and I won't go into that, but they worked well in a regulated setting. And when left to their own devices, they couldn't get their act together because they had no norms for determining what appropriate behavior was. So some take-home messages for you. A tragedy of the commons is not inevitable, but I don't want to go too far on the leaving people to their own devices is always going to solve all the world's problems either. A part of why I bring this up is because often I'll hear sort of the two ends of the spectrum. You know, if there's a problem, the solution is either private property rights or government intervention without looking at this alternative called common property. And often when common property arrangements are failing, it's not because there's a problem with common property per se, but perhaps because all of the key components aren't in place. And so the solution isn't private property. It's giving them local autonomy, giving them some buy-in, or giving them a stake in the outcome, for example. There's no single blueprint for success. So somebody who goes in with an agenda, whether it's common property is the solution or common property is not the solution, that's a mistake. We need institutional diversity. We need to be able to see what happens well in different places. And in social dilemmas, these group type settings, people often, but not always, will engage in very pro-social cooperative behavior, which creates some challenges for me as an economist when I teach principles of microeconomics and I tell students the opposite, that we're all rational, self-interested, and don't engage in pro-social behavior. We need actually a more robust model of choice than what typically is taught. And then I'm going to wrap up by saying it's easy to talk about small-scale resources because it's easier for people to know each other and work together. Scaling up from local to global issues, where greenhouse gas emissions is probably the centerpiece of that, that's challenging. As we have questions, we can talk a little bit about that. I guess I'll stop there and entertain questions. Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Jim Murphy, the Rasmussen Chair of Economics at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Following his talk on natural resource management in the developing world, he responded to questions from the audience. First, a student at UAA with family in Colombia wanted to know more about Dr. Murphy's research on natural resources in Colombia.
There's three areas that we've been to. One is on the Pacific coast. I assume you've been to Colombia and the Magdalena River, and then also up on the Caribbean coast. And we got some money from the State Department to basically do some field experiments with some of these communities to try and understand a little bit more about what their local rules and norms were for managing fisheries. These are three different fishing villages that we went to. I can talk to you more about it later afterwards if you want.
Another audience member spoke about the grazing of cattle in Wyoming on what was called tailored raising land. He went on to explain how fencing off the vast land by various different cattle owners was completely uneconomical, which gave way to branding.
No, and that sounds fairly consistent with what I'm talking about. The branding is a great way to sort of recognize, the cattle is my property, right? The grazing lands may be effectively held in common, and then the question is whether or not they're able to effectively come up with a system where we're not running too many cattle on the land, because you can have an overgrazing problem if there aren't some mechanism for limiting how much access there is.
Next, an audience member asked Professor Murphy to address the regulation of greenhouse gases and emissions on a global scale.
Do you have an hour? I guess the short answer to it is the simple one would be something related to carbon markets is going to make a lot more sense. A lot of the key components that I talk about, where we talk about sort of collective type arrangements, aren't there. It's not just a single country. It's every country. They come with different sets of rules and norms and expectations. The biggest challenge with carbon markets is going to be, again, allocation of property rights. Who gets those rights? Are they auctioned off? Are they given to emitters? How's that all going to happen? But I think at the end of the day, that probably offers some of the most promise.
Can the tragedy of the commons you spoke of be applied to the current mortgage crisis? Another audience member asked.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd think of the current mortgage crisis as a tragedy. Whether it's a tragedy of the commons, I'm not so sure. I think that's more I sort of lay a lot of it on the institutional failures.
What is the next step? How can information gathered from your research begin to be applied to different situations around the world?
Well, let me take a step back and say, one of the take-home messages, there is no panacea, is certainly important. And it's really important for any particular problem to really understand what's going on and to really understand what the problem is, to sort of start with the problem and then try and come up with solutions. As a lot of the examples I'm talking about here with small-scale problems, there's a reason why we're doing that, because I can kind of put bounds around the problem. They're in a single country, so I don't have to deal with transnational-type problems. I mean, they're not unsolvable, but it's an extra layer on top of it. And we do need to think about those types of things, because a lot of the problems, the next evolution, where a lot of this research is now going, is not just looking at the human institutions in and of themselves, but rather the relationship between the human institutions and the ecosystems as not just two, here's the ecosystem over here and here's the people over here, but they're all sort of intertwined in some way, and trying to unify that framework and then try and scale that up to think about how you would do things at larger levels. And basically what's really happening is as things become more complicated, as you introduce either complex ecosystems where we don't really know exactly, you know, think about it. A simple example would be when I cut down a tree from a common forest, and the cutting down trees can lead to soil erosion, and that leads into the streams, which affects water quality, which also affects my drinking water and may actually affect the ecosystem for the fish that I want to harvest. Now there's linkages among all these ecosystems. So it's not just about my harvesting question, but also about the harvesting of trees, but it's also harvesting trees and water quality and fish all tied together. I don't have any easy answers, but at least recognizing that there are those linkages is a logical next step.
Do you have any experiments in Alaska? Another audience member asked.
Yes, in fact, our lab right now is pretty busy running a bunch of experiments. Some of the stuff we're doing is related to compo resources. Some of it's, I guess I kind of joke, I'm a jack of all trades, master of none. This is just one of the lines of research that we're doing. So we've got some work on taking a look at the Cook Inlet natural gas situation right now. And then we also have a pretty large grant from NSF to take some of these types of compo resource questions out into villages in western Alaska, and then also into Chukotka on the other side of the Bering Sea. So that's what's going on right now. But yeah, there's a lot going on.
Lastly, an audience member mentioned communist China. He asked if there are any similarities and or differences between communism and the tragedy of the commons described by Professor Murphy.
I don't know enough about the specific situation in China to the case that you're talking about to answer that. But I'm glad you bring up the word communism, because a lot of what I'm talking about sort of does sound like communism, doesn't it? And I wouldn't take it, what I have to say as like what we need here is communism, guys. That's certainly not the message. And if somehow I came across implying that, no. let me get that out there. No. Right, there's some meaningful differences between what we're talking about here. When I talk about, there's some similarities and some meaningful differences. When I think of sort of a failed Soviet state, a lot of that was actually kind of similar to the Pilgrims problem. A common property regime imposed on people, not necessarily by choice and not necessarily by design from the bottom up. And it was sort of a top down type of thing without the buy-in of people. And there's a huge difference between those, but in the specific case of China, it's hard for me to say.
Thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
This concludes Alaska World Affairs Council Presents with Dr. Jim Murphy, Rasmussen Chair of Economics at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Dr. Murphy responded to questions from the audience following his talk entitled Natural Resource Management in the Developing World, recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska on Friday, October 31st, 2008. These broadcasts are produced by KSKA Public Radio in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. Visit kska.org to sign up for free podcasts of Alaska World Affairs Council Presents. You can also sign up for email updates about the show or share your comments with us and other listeners. This has been a presentation of KSKA in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.